Look, it's Sunday, March 29th. The White House is currently locked in a standoff with the press, and a partial government shutdown is starting to bite. Between the Department of Homeland Security running out of cash and the president picking fights with journalists, the stability we were promised feels like a punchline. Here is what's actually happening. Funding for the Department of Homeland Security has officially dried up, which is why your flight was probably delayed. TSA workers aren't getting paid, and the disruptions are getting worse. In a move that's classic for this White House, the president issued an executive order to pay those workers from reserve funds. He's also been spending time putting his signature on currency and renaming institutions. It's a bold choice to prioritize personal branding while the literal machinery of the state is grinding to a halt. While this is happening, the administration has opened a second front against the domestic press. They've been leaning on the Department of Justice to investigate prominent journalists, including Don Lemon, under the auspices of civil rights era statutes. Lemon argues this is a deliberate play to flip the script on racial victimhood and silence dissent. Beyond the legal pressure, the White House is restricting reporters and making implicit threats about revoking broadcasting licenses. It's a pretty transparent attempt to control the narrative by intimidating the people who report it. Lemon's take is that this isn't just about him. It's an assault on the concept of a shared reality. He's moved into independent journalism, which he says is growing because people are desperate for authenticity that they aren't getting from legacy media. Ironically, by targeting him, the administration has given him a much larger platform. It's the Streisand effect, but with higher stakes for the First Amendment. Finally, while we're talking about broken systems, let's look at how we handle addiction in this country. The current U.S. model is basically a revolving door. Insurance usually covers about 28 days of residential care, but experts say the risk of relapse stays high for 4 or 5 years. This has led to the Florida shuffle, where people just cycle through predatory, low-quality rehabs without ever getting better. There's a lot of talk right now about a model in Italy called San Patrignano. It's a self-contained village on 700 acres, where 850 residents live and work for an average of 3 years. They run vineyards, bakeries, and textile shops, and those businesses fund more than half of the operating budget. They don't use 12-step programs or addiction medications. They use community as the treatment. Researchers say over 70% of people who finish the program are still drug-free 3 years later. Compare that to the U.S., where some studies suggest the 12-step success rate is closer to 30%. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is reportedly a big fan of this model. But actually building something like this in the U.S. is a massive lift. We're talking about years of vocational training and huge capital investment, which doesn't exactly fit the short-term, insurance-friendly model we have now. Plus, there are critics who say San Patrignano looks a bit too much like cheap labor or even a cult if it's not properly overseen. All of these things, the shutdown, the press crackdown, are converging in the No Kings protests popping up across the country. People are out in the streets over everything from federal immigration enforcement in Minnesota to basic government overreach. Activists are moving to encrypted apps because they're afraid of being targeted by the government. It's a vibe of deep-seated distrust. And when the government responds by putting the president's name on currency while the TSA isn't getting paid, that distrust usually doesn't go away. So, the government is breaking, but Stanford professor Andy Hall thinks we can use AI to fix the parts of democracy that are currently failing. He's calling for a pivot toward what he calls political superintelligence. According to Hall, this happens in three layers. First, the information layer, using AI to help citizens navigate government services and providing policymakers with better economic forecasting. Second, the representation layer, creating advocate agents that monitor government meetings and suggest voting strategies based on your personal values. Finally, the governance layer, a constitutional convention for the AI age, to create binding frameworks that distribute power. Look, the idea of an AI advocate sounds great on paper, until you realize it's basically a digital lobbyist for your dinner table. If we can't even agree on what a fact is in 2025, I'm skeptical that a bot controlled by a black box algorithm is going to be the thing that saves the republic. It feels like we're trying to solve a human trust problem with more math, which historically hasn't worked out great. Speaking of trust, it is currently evaporating in the world of audio. Deepfake voice calls have become so sophisticated that they're fooling both humans and the algorithms meant to catch them. According to a recent report, roughly a quarter of Americans have received a deepfake voice call in the past year alone. The financial stakes are getting massive. Global losses from deepfake fraud are projected to hit tens of billions of dollars by 2027. Because we can no longer trust our ears, the tech industry is moving toward a system of content credentials. This is being led by the C2PA, a group that includes Adobe, Microsoft, and Google. They're developing a way to cryptographically sign audio files. It's like a digital watermark that records the origin, the device used, and any changes made to the file. If someone tries to tamper with it, the mathematical thread breaks and the file is flagged. This isn't just about stopping scammers from pretending to be your grandma. It's about stopping the liar's dividend. That's the phenomenon where a politician or a CEO is caught on a real recording saying something damning, and they simply claim it was an AI deepfake. If every real recording has a digital signature, they can't hide behind that excuse anymore. But there is a massive downside to this authenticated future. If we decide that only verified audio is trustworthy, we're essentially killing anonymity. For whistleblowers, dissidents, or anyone who needs to speak truth to power without putting their name on a blockchain, this is a disaster. It turns public discourse into a VIP club where you have to show your digital ID just to be heard. So, we're heading toward a two-tiered system. On one side, you have the verified voices of the establishment. On the other, you have everyone else, the unverified, the anonymous, and the marginalized, who will be treated with automatic suspicion. It's a shitty choice. Do we stay in the current mess where fraudsters run wild, or do we build a surveillance architecture that might silence the very people who need to be heard? Given how much we love safety over freedom lately, I think we know which way this is going. Anyway, while the digital world tries to figure out what's real, the world of horse racing is dealing with some very physical problems. Kentucky is currently seeing a massive surge in betting handle, and it isn't just luck. It's a calculated result of higher purses driven by historical horse racing machines and some aggressive new tweaks to help people actually place their bets. At Keeneland, they've cut simulcast refresh times down to 5 seconds to stop those annoying late odds shifts that drive bettors crazy. They're also rolling out player-friendly wagers, like a late pick 3 with a lower 15% takeout. But the move that's raising eyebrows is the superfecta. They've hiked the minimum bet from 10 cents to 50 cents. The goal here is to price out the blind luck players who flood the pool with tiny combination bets and instead reward the serious handicappers with bigger payouts, which honestly makes sense if you're trying to keep the ecosystem alive. But while Kentucky is thriving, California is basically an emergency room. The industry is watching a steady exodus of talent from the West Coast. Big-name trainers like Bob Baffert are moving operations to Churchill Downs and Oaklawn, largely because California lacks the casino revenue that pads the purses in other states. There's a real fear among analysts that California racing might not even exist past 2028. When you couple that with a wave of high-profile retirements, guys like Tom Amos and Roger Atfield, you start to see a change in the guard that isn't exactly voluntary. According to reports from Dale Romans, many veteran trainers are just done. They're citing the skyrocketing costs of feed and labor, but also the massive administrative headache of new HISA regulations. These are old-school horsemen who spent their lives in the dirt, and now they're being told they need to be tech-literate office managers to keep up with the paperwork. For a lot of them, the tough way to make a living just isn't worth it anymore. It's a weird moment for the sport. You have one side of the country engineering a betting boom, and the other side wondering if their tracks will be turned into condos by the end of the decade. It turns out that horse racing, much like the horses themselves, is at a crossroads. doesn't handle sudden shifts in the environment particularly well. Speaking of environments that are actually growing, let's look at ESPN's new bet on women's sports. ESPN is making a hard pivot. They're launching Women's Sports Sundays, a new programming franchise designed to move women's sports out of the niche interest category and directly into the center of their business model. They aren't doing this to be nice. They're doing it because their current inventory for women's sports is largely sold out. The network is integrating these games into prime time and launching new shows like WNBA Countdown and Football W. The goal here is to replicate the Monday Night Football effect, creating a predictable, high-value slot that advertisers can rely on, regardless of which specific sport is in season. According to ESPN, this moves the category from startup mode into growth mode. Honestly, it's about time they realize that leaving money on the table isn't a great strategy. The numbers back up the shift. Ad sales for women's college basketball are up 72% for the regular season over the last 2 years, and tournament revenue has jumped a massive 134%. We're also seeing major capital flight into team ownership, like the recent $250 million acquisition of Angel City FC. This influx of billionaire cash is finally funding the boring but necessary stuff, like better practice facilities and actual investment in coaching staff. It's a cynical reality, but in sports, you haven't really arrived until the people in suits stop talking about your potential and start talking about your inventory. For women's sports, that transition is finally happening, and ESPN is betting $250 million that the trend isn't going anywhere. So, while ESPN is building a brand, there's a news organization you've probably never heard of that's quietly taking over your local paper. The Center Square is currently the fastest-growing nonprofit newswire in the country, and they've just hit a massive distribution milestone. They are now providing statehouse and economic reporting to over 1,350 media partners nationwide. According to their own metrics, that gives them a reach of about 141 million Americans. If you haven't heard of them, that's actually by design. They basically act as a ghostwriter for the local news industry, filling the massive gap left behind as local papers across the country have gutted their statehouse bureaus to stay afloat. The strategy is pretty straightforward. They provide the content for free or low cost to local publishers who can't afford to send a reporter to the state capital anymore. This allows those local outlets to keep running accountability stories without actually having to pay for the boots on the ground. For the Center Square, it means their reporting gets blasted out through established, trusted local mastheads rather than sitting on a lonely website somewhere. Now, here's the thing about where they came from. The organization has faced significant scrutiny because of its origins within a network funded by conservative philanthropy. Critics have labeled it a rebranded right-wing mouthpiece, which is a hell of a hurdle to clear when you're trying to claim the mantle of objective news. But the publisher, Chris Krug, is pushing back hard on that narrative. He points to the Ad Fontes Media Bias Chart, which currently ranks the Center Square among the top 30 news organizations for accuracy and fairness. Krug describes their mission as pocketbook journalism, focusing strictly on government spending and economic policy. He says they are intentionally avoiding solutions-based journalism or opinion pieces because he wants to draw a hard line between reporting and advocacy. It's an interesting play, honestly, in a media landscape where everyone is pivoting to perspective or voice to find an audience. Krug is betting that being a dry, facts-only wire service is the actual gap in the market. Look, statehouse reporting is a dying art. Most people couldn't name their state representative if you put a gun to their head, even though those are the people deciding how your property taxes work or how your local schools are funded. The Center Square is stepping into that vacuum with a massive amount of scale. The skeptical take here, and it's one worth having, is that government accountability and pocketbook journalism are often phrases used as a polite way to frame a small government, fiscal conservative agenda. By focusing exclusively on what things cost and how the government is spending money, you're already choosing a specific lens for the news. That said, if you're a local editor in a two-person newsroom and you have the choice between running a wire story about a new state tax bill or running nothing at all, you're going to take the story. That is how the center square has managed to get inside the House for 141 million people. They realize that in the current media economy, it's better to be the plumbing than the faucet. While we're on the subject of discipline, let's talk about why your to-do list is probably a lie. Look, the productivity world is currently obsessed with fake work. According to recent reporting on business scaling, entrepreneurs are increasingly trapping themselves in a cycle of busyness that feels like progress, but actually stalls growth. The data suggests that high achievers are burning out on low-impact administrative tasks. Think Inbox Zero or Calendar Tetris, while avoiding the uncomfortable high-impact actions that actually drive revenue. Honestly, it's a shitty realization to have that you've spent 10 hours working and accomplished exactly nothing of substance. But that's the reality of disguised procrastination. If the hustle is failing you, the Stoics have a different angle on the same problem. As reported in recent discussions on resilience, the Stoic principle of euthymia, maintaining a steady sense of your own path, is being framed as the ultimate defense against anxious discontent. Seneca's advice is making a comeback here, specifically, the daily walk as a magical cure-all for mental stillness. The core idea is that external success is transient, so you might as well zoom out to what they call Plato's view to see your struggles as part of a timeless human rhythm. It sounds a bit lofty, but the takeaway is practical. Stop being your own harshest critic. On the more meditative side, Zen master Henry Shukman recently demonstrated a progressive grounding technique on Dr. Rangan Chatterjee's podcast. The news here is the scale of adoption. Over 300,000 people just completed a 30-day challenge, logging 7.6 million minutes of practice. The goal wasn't just stress relief, but a shift toward boundless awareness, treating your thoughts as a screen rather than the reality. It's a grounded way to stop being so reactive to every piece of bad news that hits your phone. Not for nothing, but if you need a real distraction from the state of the world, Fantasy Premier League is providing plenty of stress of its own. Game Week 31 is in the rearview, and it was a bit of a bloodbath for some of the most popular assets in the game. According to the Fantasy Football Delayed Gratification podcast, the week was defined by a few massive swings in individual performance that are forcing a lot of managers to rethink their builds heading into the weekend. The big winner was Anthony Gordon, whose goal made him one of the few reliable returns in a week where the template players largely fell flat. On the other end of the spectrum, it was a disaster for Harry Maguire and James Maddison owners. Maguire picked up a red card, and Maddison chipped in with an own goal, resulting in significant point deductions that likely tanked a few mini-league leads. Beyond the cards and own goals, some of the most owned players in the game, Cole Palmer, Brennan Johnson, and Eberechi Eze, posted poor returns. It's a reminder that even the essential guys can go cold at the exact moment you need them to pull through. Honestly, seeing Palmer blank feels like a glitch in the matrix at this point, but it's the reality we're dealing with. On the defensive side, the podcast noted that Lewis Hall and James Justin from Leicester were strong performers regardless of their team's overall inconsistency. There's also talk in the air about potential rule changes for defensive scoring in future seasons, though nothing is set in stone yet. Looking at the watch list, the advice is to pivot. Underperformers are being cleared out for guys with better fixtures or differential potential. The names to watch right now are Matty Cash, Morgan Rogers, and Ollie Watkins. Watkins is the obvious one, but Rogers is an interesting shout if you're looking to free up funds for a heavy-hitting midfield. For Game Week 32, the captaincy conversation is centering on Bruno Fernandes. He's got a home fixture against Brighton, which looks a lot more appetizing than the away trips facing Erling Haaland and other premium options. Betting your week on Bruno always feels like a high-stakes gamble with your own sanity, but the data apparently likes the matchup. As for transfers, the move seems to be offloading Palmer or Brennan Johnson. The podcast is looking at Harry Wilson as a replacement, or doubling down on Arsenal assets like Bukayo Saka and Declan Rice. Rice has been playing out of his skin lately, but it's always a question of whether that translates to FPL points or just real-life football excellence. Finally, the chip strategy is getting aggressive. The plan being floated is to burn the free hit chip in the potential double game week 33, while holding on to the triple captain for a later window. It's about navigating these final weeks without tripping over your own feet. Which, let's be real, is easier said than done when you're staring at a Harry Maguire red card on a Tuesday night. A few other things worth knowing before you head out. First up, New York City is currently spending more per homeless person than the median household in the U.S. actually earns. The city is effectively funding a massive bureaucracy that makes the status quo comfortable enough to stay in, but provides almost zero off-ramps to actually getting back on your feet. When you spend that much money to manage a crisis instead of solving it, you aren't fighting homelessness, you're just subsidizing it. And then there's DoorDash, which apparently won the delivery wars by obsessing over the last 10 feet of the handoff. They ran tens of thousands of failed experiments to figure out why a driver standing in a lobby for 3 minutes ruins the math of a whole zip code. It turns out their real product isn't food. It's a logistics engine that finally figured out how to master the messy physical world where everyone else just gave up. Honestly, it's a hell of a lot of work just to get a lukewarm burrito to your door. That's the news. It's a lot to take in, but hey, at least we're not the ones trying to solve the logistics of a Manhattan lobby. Go take that stoic walk